Welcome to the Desperately Seeking Self podcast, the podcast that's exploring the not-so-filtered side of life and giving you no BS strategies, tips, and tools, and maybe a little laughter along the way so you can fall in love with your life again. I'm your host, Brooke Collins. Let's get started. Welcome to the Desperately Seeking Self podcast, Arlena Allen. I am so excited to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
I am really just inspired by a lot of the things that you do. And I love to find someone who I can consider a air quote soul sister who is into sobriety, who's been sober for a while, who also helps women empower themselves to be the best versions of themselves. And that's what I live for, really. It's like my jam.
Same.
Why don't you just tell the audience or all of us a little bit about yourself and how you got to be such a badass. You know, you're a hypnotherapist, you have a podcast, you're a podcast host, you have all kinds of things that you do, a coach. It's the list is endless for all the things you do. So
workaholic, tell us how you got where you are. Add that to the list.
Oh yeah, alcoholic.
A little bit of workaholism. So I got sober April 23rd of 94. So it's been a long time. And I immediately broke the rules. They said, don't get into a relationship. And I met my husband 5 months in. And he just celebrated 33 years. So I like to say that we're off to a good start.
Yeah.
Because he's my favorite.
It's a great start.
I know. No, he's my favorite person ever. And I have to attribute it to, you know, the 12-step program. Because, you know, I feel like the thing that comes in between relationships is resentment. And it wasn't until I was made aware of this program and steps and all these different concepts that there was a way to actually resolve resentment. Resentment's like a wedge in a relationship. And, you know, over time, that wedge can just get so big. But if you have a way to, you know, metabolize that resentment and process it to resolution and sort of pivot, you know, make tweaks and adjustments along the way, you can go the distance, right? And so I felt like that's where we're at.
I love that you said pivot, because to me, I'm always pivot, like literally like Friends. In my head, I am like pivoting myself into oblivion all the time.
Right. That's so funny. Pivot. Yeah. I love that show. And that's kind of like the end of the story, but the beginning of the story was that I grew up in a family. My parents were really nice people, but they divorced when I was really young. And another which was very traumatic for me. And then the other significant, traumatic event was that I was sexually abused by a neighbor when I was about five. It started when I was about 5 or 6 years old, really young. And it was a neighbor girl. So that totally, it messed up my head so hard for a very long time. But those things that happened to me sort of instilled this idea that I was not good enough. I wasn't worthy. I was a bad person. And I sort of from that point on was on this quest to fix what was broken. I had this idea that I was broken. And what I know now is that I was not broken. I was wounded. Right? We get these soul bruises, I like to call them, because we experience these wounds and they're not visible on the outside, but we carry them with us. And there is this lie that time heals all wounds. It doesn't. The pain waits. And we build our lives upon these lies and these wounds. And it's literally building your house on sand instead of on a solid foundation. But my parents are very nice people. They did not have drug or alcohol problems. Daddy's from Kentucky, very religious, 400 years of ministers on my daddy's side. His people came like pre-Civil War, so they've been here a long time. My mother was from Mexico City, and so she was first generation. So I was kind of, I'm 53, so when I was growing up, they didn't consider like Mexican American kids like me as biracial. It really wasn't like talked about like kids that were maybe black and white, right? African American and white. So, but we were definitely biracial. And I sort of had that experience where I was always different. Like when I was with my Hispanic family, I was the white kid. And when I was with my white family, I was the Hispanic kid. It was weird. even though like the people on the Mexican side, they were like Spanish. So a lot of them are like blonde, blue eyed, which is kind of an interesting dynamic. That's a whole nother thing. But all this to say that I grew up feeling different and alone and afraid is really how it was. And very early on when I was about, it was less than 10, I always say it was less than 10 because I really have a hard time wrapping my head around the idea that I was so young and felt the need to change the way I felt, but I did. My parents had divorced. My mom had gone out to dinner. She was allowed to leave the house. So she went to dinner. And I decided it would be a great idea to drink some of the booze that was in a dusty old bottle in under the cabinet. And I was left home alone with my older sister, and who was the compliant child. I was not. But I remember that first drink like it was yesterday. The booze burned my lips. It burned all the way down. But when it hit bottom, that warmth spread through my entire body and the juxtaposition between those two feelings. I didn't really realize how bad I felt until I felt good, right? Like all the self-consciousness, the self-hatred, the self-loathing, all the feelings of that I was a bad kid, those were all suddenly removed. And I was left with this relief feeling. And that is the feeling that I've chased my entire life, right? Like who doesn't want to feel that even now, right? That good feeling. But yeah, I got really sick. I threw up everywhere. My sister cleaned me up and put me to bed. And that sort of began our alcoholic codependent relationship. And, you know, I had asked her once, I was like, why didn't you say anything to mom? And she said, because I would have gotten in trouble. So it wasn't until I got sober many years later, when I was doing the 4-step, that I began to see this pattern that I grew up with this idea that you didn't have to take responsibility for yourself, but you had to take responsibility for others, right? So that led me to a place where I was disempowered. I was blaming others. And I crashed and burned basically when I was 25 years old. I just had many experiences from the first drink to the last where it was like, I like to encapsulate my using experience by saying that if it was in a bottle, a bag, or blue jeans, I was doing it. I would use anything. I love that. I totally bought into that whole Cinderella story that Prince Charming was going to come rescue my ass. Like I thought it was
rescue
either.
You.
Yeah. I thought it was going to either be money or love that was going to save me. So I became super obsessed with making money. So I had a job since I've been 13 years old. I'm 53. It's been a minute.
Yeah.
And I was kissing a lot of frogs looking for someone to come save me. And, you know, what the interesting thing was is, you know, when I finally was like, got sick and tired of being sick and tired is basically what happened. I got to that dark place of, you know, how did I get here again? I was a puker. I used to say that if I didn't have splash marks on my shoes the next day, it wasn't a good time. I just had to make a joke out of everything. Because I was so full of shame. I was so full of shame about my using experience, you know, waking up going, oh my God, that's not my ceiling. You know, like, who are you? Oh, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you was not an uncommon phrase on a Sunday morning for me. Good times.
I think for a lot of us, though, you know, that's you wake up and you're like, I had this one. I woke up once and I didn't know where I was. And I looked back at the wall and, there was this giant poster of Notorious B.I.G. And I was like, well, this definitely is the right person. Cause I love, you know, old school gangster rap. I'm not gangster at all, but I love it. Like,
oh, really?
I was
that's
like
the
16,
first thing I thought of when I saw you. Oh, she likes yeah, yeah.
But like when White I was woman. Like 16, you know, the East Coast, West Coast, like right, Tupac, right, right, Biggie Smalls, like it was a big thing. And I was like, always East Coast, always whatever. So that was like one of my experiences where I was like, at least I'm kind of in the right room.
Yeah,
nice to meet you.
At least there's that. So funny. I joke about it now. Oh, good times. But yeah, so that's the girl. I was that girl and just desperate for love. And you know, what's funny is when I finally was like, okay, I can't do this anymore. I had a horrible night with my sister. She and I went out and, I got super drunk and I had just broken up with my policeman boyfriend who was married. I like to say now that the only married man I sleep with now is my husband. Okay. Yeah, which he appreciates. But yeah, sure. I had just broken up with my married policeman boyfriend and I was actually dating his best friend and the best friend stood me up at the bar. So I was obviously brokenhearted because whatever. And when she was driving my truck home and we passed the married boyfriend doing a field sobriety test on somebody. And apparently I lost my damn mind and punched the windshield in a couple places and tried to crash the car and tried to jump out. And my poor sister was trying to control me. Good luck with that. And we almost made it home, but apparently I kicked her in the face and gave her a bloody nose, like while she was driving. I know. And she managed to pull a car over in the neighborhood that we grew up in and went to a neighbor's house and the police were called. And for whatever reason, they didn't take me to jail. But that's when I woke up the next morning with that incomprehensible demoralization where I was like, I can't do this anymore. And she had gone to Al-Anon and I was like, for me? I was
still... For me? Wait, what? Who are you going to Al-Anon for?
What is that? Why are you going? I was very like confused. Like I was completely self-centered, but incapable of self-examination. And it's such a weird place to be, right?
Yeah.
It makes sense makes sense to everybody else, but I was confused. Sharp as a marble, yeah. As I like to say. But that's what alcohol does to your brain. It's not a good thing. And weed. I was a terrible weed smoker. I used to, you know, and it would give me asthma. I used to say it like when I was growing up, I was going to church a lot and the pastor's daughter was the biggest weed smoker I'd ever met. One time she told me that not being high was her altered reality. And I was like, I want to be just like you when I grow up. It's like, you're my hero. Yeah.
Seems legit to me. Yeah. I mean,
yeah. I was like, oh my God, I want to be just like you. But the idea was I just was trying to numb my feelings out. I just had no coping skills, right? And zero coping skills. And my mom didn't know how to teach me any coping skills. You know, my dad left when I was growing up. He was the nurturing one and she was just angry. And so I just had terrible self-esteem when I was growing up. And so I think that's what the drinking was all about. I just hated who I was. And then I met these guys that were, I was a sales rep for a transportation company. So I was dealing with a lot of men and two of my customers were in the program. And they started breaking these ideas down to me. Like if you don't take the first drink, you can't get drunk. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And I was like desperate to be anybody but me. Right. And so they, ushered me into the rooms, but they were these fine, upstanding men of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they were like, the women work with the women. So they ushered me in, took me to my first meetings. I choked on the word anonymity, as we do. They would say, welcome to the newcomer. And I thought I was under the interrogation spotlight. I was like, oh shit. It was so embarrassing, but I was so desperate. But you know what's funny? It took 2 years between the incident with my sister to the time I got to the rooms because that 2 year period, I had a lot of questions. It's like, what is an alcoholic? When did I cross the line? What about all the other people that are drinking just like me? Are they alcoholic? Just one question led to more questions, and it was like opening Pandora's box. But it took me 2 years to finally show up into the rooms. But when I showed up, I had that gift of desperation that you talked about too, right? It's like I hated who I was. They said, you have to change everything. I was all like, sign me up. There is nothing that I want, right? The one thing that terrified me was they said that I had to work with the women. And I had spent so much time and energy decorating the outside. I felt like I didn't have anything to offer on the inside. My mom and my sister and I did not have good relationships. So I was terrified of women when I first got sober. But I was so desperate to be sober. I was willing to do anything that they told me to do, including work with women. And so, but I did, I found a sponsor. I picked her because she remembered my name the second time she met me. And I asked her, my name's hard to remember. So people, you know, when someone remembers my name, I was like, oh shit. But it was like the skies had parted and it was like, oh, yeah, the sun was shining on her. I was like, angels were singing. I was like, I guess it's you. You're the one. And I was terrified of relapsing. And I kept hearing about this ominous fourth step that people would do steps 1, 2, and 3 and relapse. And I was all, hell no, that is not going to happen to me. And I'm slightly competitive. So they were like, oh, only one in 100 people, you know, get this thing or whatever. And I was like, that's going to be me. It's going to be me.
One.
Yeah. Yeah. It's going to be me. I will compete and kill myself if I have to get there. But, I asked her if she would listen to my inventory, and you know what she said to me? She said, I would be honored. And then she said, but we're going to start with step one. So that's what we did. And when I worked all the steps, and you know, I learned that in the fourth step that I was, taking inappropriate responsibility for others and not appropriate responsibility for myself. And I quickly learned that I got this idea that if I gave up blame, that I could, you know, be empowered and really change my life. And I don't know where that idea came from. Probably didn't come from me, because all my ideas were polar opposite of like spiritual, you know, like you hear, I heard things. Yeah. I heard things like, if you're resentful at someone, you should pray for them. And I was like, you mean slash their tires?
Correct.
Right. Oh, pray for them that they get everything that you want. And I was like, that's crazy. But nothing I was doing was working.
That was a hard concept for me too. I was like, what?
It wasn't.
I mean, I think it's hard for people to wrap their brains around.
Yeah.
Even people without alcohol problems. You want me to well wish someone that's causing me pain? What?
Yeah, because the assumption there is that you're innocent.
Right.
Right.
There's no guilt, you know. There's no people. I didn't look at things as 50-50, that I was giving 50% of whatever communication or relationship I was having for a very long time.
Did you ever read that book, The Road Less Traveled by M. Scott Peck?
No.
Oh my God, it's such a good book. But that was in the 2 year stint that I was trying to figure out who I was. I pretty much lived in the self-help section at Barnes & Noble. And one of the books I read was M. Scott Peck. And he talked about how every relationship is like 50-50 and that we have to own our part. And that was a pretty original concept to me. I was like, I was confused because I thought I was the victim. Turns out I was provoking people and they were responding in a negative way. And all I saw was them responding. I didn't had no visibility into how I was, no awareness into how I was affecting others.
So you were able to, through sobriety, quit slashing people's tires. And
well, I never did, but I thought about it.
I egged people's cars in high school. That was my, and then I did have an incident with a golf club and a car at one time in my drinking career. So
allegedly,
allegedly. Yeah. They wanted to arrest me. Thank God my ex-husband's mother owned the vehicle that I tanked because she wouldn't press charges. So she was in my life and that she didn't want to press charges because my ex-husband was like, arrest her. And I'm, you know, like,
wow.
But yeah, so that was one of those things where it seemed totally normal to me because I thought it in my head, like, yeah, I'm going to take a golf club to that fucker's car. Yeah. Like totally normal. I mean, I really thought like, this is so normal.
I think
everybody does this.
Carrie Underwood song now.
Exactly.
Talks about it. Yeah.
And no, it wasn't normal. And I think there's no lesson learned about taking responsibility for your actions or holding yourself accountable until the police walk in and then you're like, oh.
Oh, my bad.
but you went through, I like that you had a 2 year period of asking a bunch of questions. Cause I think that it's an important journey for anybody, like curiosity about things. And I think for most people struggling with alcoholism or even low self-esteem, there's a lot of questions that we ask that are just meant to keep us stuck. Like, well, if so-and-so is drinking as much as I am, then are they an alcoholic? No. So then I'm not an alcoholic. It like green lights the behavior that you want to change, but you don't really want to change at that time. Right. Don't you think that it opens up a whole new kind of, you get to see things a little differently as your questions evolve, because you can't outrun yourself or your own truth for too long. I mean, you can for a minute, but I don't think you can outrun it for too long. And I think 2 years is a long haul of asking questions. And
that was, that was really painful. And you know what's so interesting? After interviewing 187 people on my podcast, you know, this 2 year period is not uncommon. You know, it's not uncommon to have an extended period of time where you have to ask the questions and you have to try to shoot all the angles, right? It's like, okay, this is a problem. How am I going to solve it, right? Is it reading books? Is it a glass of water between each drinks? Is it switching from beer, hard alcohol to, like, I had to try all the things because it was my coping skill. It was my favorite thing. And addiction is interesting because I follow this guy, Dr. Andrew Huberman. He has a podcast called Huberman Lab, and he's a neurobiologist out of Stanford. And he talks about his definition of addiction was really interesting. It's the narrowing of things that bring you pleasure, right? It's like we like people that are addicted, you know. And I love the neurochemistry and the biology aspect of it because it sort of depersonalizes it. Because before I got sober, I just thought I was an immoral, horrible person. And when I found out, oh, alcohol is addictive. What is addiction? You know, what about, you know, non-addictive marijuana? You know, can I eat acid and smoke non-addictive marijuana like a normal person? Turns out, no. I can't do anything. But those were my coping skills. Sorry, I feel like I'm all over the place. But
you're right on, because I can't even have ice cream sandwiches without coping with 12 of them in like a 3 day period. Like,
yeah,
I can't, that's what I can't stop. Like even non-addictive anything, like it's, I'm going to.
Yeah. And here's the thing. The purpose of addiction is distraction. It's distraction from pain. And so I don't care if you're using food, sex, shopping, workaholism. Let's not talk about Netflix. I'm still not ready to surrender Netflix, but, it's like all these coping mechanisms that we use are trying, it's a self-preservation mechanism. Like I say the drugs and alcohol saved my life because when I was 14 and 15 years old, if I had to feel all the feelings, I would have killed myself. Like that was the choice. Either I'm going to medicate and numb my feelings or I don't think I'm going to survive this. I hated who I was and it was just a very dark place. I was in a very dark place, but that's where the addiction began. And it happened so early. And what I know now about neuroscience and biology is that the younger you are, when you start using things, even if it's tobacco, I interviewed Dr. Judith Grisel. She has a PhD in neuroscience and she wrote a book called Never Enough. And it's about the experience and neuroscience of addiction. And when we look at it from that perspective, it depersonalizes it. It takes out the shame and the guilt and go, oh my God, I didn't have a fighting chance. I really didn't. You know, and when the younger you are that you start, the more the bigger your chances are. I think if you start I forget what age she said, your brain doesn't stop developing till like you're 25. So, if you start at a young age using things that increase your dopamine, it sort of like greases the rails for later. And then you have a 1 in 25% chance of becoming an addict. And it doesn't matter what, because, what ends up getting triggered is your dopamine reward system gets all screwed up. And
pleasure, right? Like instant pleasure. It's what you need to hit.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that, I think that that's a common misconception is that dopamine triggers pleasure. What dopamine is, it's like a save button. You experience pleasure like serotonin or other pleasure chemicals. And dopamine is the save button that says, don't forget what this, you did this thing and this is the feeling that you got. So let's save that. Dopamine is like the vehicle. Okay. It's like
it's like the on-demand record button.
It is. Don't forget this good thing. You know, dopamine is released after. So we when we start drinking and using, we skew our dopamine reward system, and then it sets off a series of other neurochemical sequences that just, it's a negative spiral that leads downward is the simplest way to put it, you know. And Dr. Anna Lemke is a chief of the addiction program at Stanford. And she talks about how we all have, in terms of neurochemistry and psychology, we have this balance scale, like a teeter-totter, you know, that your brain is always seeking homeostasis. So if you front-load pleasure, you get the equal opposite in pain on the back end. And it works the other way too. So we know people, in theory, who run, they enjoy it. God bless them. If someone's not chasing me, I ain't running. But right. But like people who exercise, that's front loading the pain experience up front, and you get the runner's high on the back end. So your brain is seeking to balance out these neurochemicals, and then you go back to balance. And so it's just, you know, everything comes with a price tag. Everything in life has a price tag. And so what sobriety and recovery is about, it's about doing the work up front. Like doing the work of recovery is painful, but then you get the positive on the other end, right? And so we either suffer the pains of growth or the pains of picking up the price tag from a negative behavior. So I have just learned to sort of flip the script. I have sort of learned in recovery that if I do my recovery work first, then the rest of my experience, whether it's that day or over the long haul, is pleasurable. And I'm a pleasure junkie. So I've sort of rewired my brain that way.
That's so interesting. I guess I've never thought about the pain and the pleasure needing to balance one another out. Like, I don't know why that's not really ever occurred to me, but it makes complete sense now that you just talked about it. And I'm not a runner. Pain and then hitting the high after, like, no. That's not me either. So I think just learning the way we cope, right? Like, it's how you are. I think anyone who experiences trauma becomes, you either soothe with things and then the addiction comes in, or you withhold and block yourself off and kind of detach maybe a little. And that's where you get like these different ways of handling situations. It's just so, I mean, I love that you have a husband who's sober for so long. And I really think the other part is where the spiritual person in me, mm-hmm. and the universe doesn't put you in the wrong place at the wrong time type of person, and synchronicities. It's interesting that you were in sales and you were dealing with so many men. And then there's these two guys who are sober who start planting these seeds to you. Right. And you were young. I mean, but so the fact that you even picked up on those, because at 24, I would have been like, yeah, okay, bro, you know, like, yeah. Have fun with that. Like, I wouldn't have even been able to listen to it. So I look at those things like universal. Think about how maybe you don't even talk to them today, but like how, what a pivotal role they played in your life.
Oh my God, it's so pivotal. Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting because I kind of got away from the spiritual aspect. I grew up in the church and I had been begging God to fix me my entire life. Right. It turns out I was asking the wrong question. Right. But in my mind, I thought that God had abandoned me. Right. But it wasn't until my coping skill was no longer working. Like, drugs and alcohol were my coping skill and they were no longer working for me. And let's be honest, men too. I have had a healthy, like, love addiction, you know, using people to seeking outside myself to feel better. I needed that external validation. Right. And that's, you know, and now I understand, you know, I've been through hypnotherapy, you know, and I'm an obsessive learner. I am an obsessive learner. That's the one thing I had going for me. And I knew that, you know, all these things, all this stuff that I was learning was going to help me get sober in the end. I lost my train of thought. I think that's what happens when you're 53 and menopausal. And
I just took a drink of my water. So you're like, oh, she's taking a drink. I think that is what happens. Is because you turned your back, you're asking the wrong questions.
Then you know,
I think you just.
I gave up on it.
Got jaded. Yeah.
I gave up on it. I got frustrated and I gave up on God. But when I was ready to change and get sober, the first thing was, God, please help me. right? And then I went to the rooms, and then they, you know, and then they told me that I could redefine what this higher power meant to me. And that was my saving grace. And that's what helped me. And then I had many spiritual experiences over the years. I've been sober a long time. And it's so funny. They say that we have a quick forgetter. Those of us that are in recovery, we have a quick forgetter. And I've had so many like amazing, like serendipitous or spiritual experiences, God shots, whatever you want to call them. And still after some time that goes by, I'm like, yeah, but I'm not sure, you know? So, and then I had one after my mother passed away. My mother was diagnosed with terminal cancer on October 12th, and she died a month ago today, November 3rd. And it was 22 days from diagnosis to death. It was fast. And, but you know what? I stayed sober through that whole experience. I was giving her, I had access to liquid morphine and lorazepam and tramadol and all this stuff. And I took really good care of my mom. And I was so grateful for that experience. So grateful for my sobriety. And the day after she passed away, I was on a 7 a.m. meeting, and it just ended. And my husband opens the door and he goes, "Oh my God, you have to come outside." The sky was ablaze. It was like this brilliant pink and red and gold. And often I'm looking at a picture of it now. I had actually posted a picture of it online, and a girlfriend, one of my gals, downloaded it and put it on a card and mailed it to me. So now it's on my wall and I stand on it. But I walked out and it was like my mom. Sorry. It was like my mom was on the other side letting me know that she made it, that she made it to the other side. It was just such, I've never seen a sunrise like that. The sky, I've never seen anything like that. And it took away, I was like, all these times that I doubt whether there's a higher power or some kind of loving force, it's like, okay, I get it. I just knew to my core that she was okay, that she made it to the other. She was saying, "I made it to the other side." And that was definitely like a spiritual experience, undeniable to me. And it was so personal. And that's what I have found about these spiritual experiences. They are so personal. It's not like the, well, I guess in this case, it really was like God came down from heaven and just like showed up. You know what I mean? Yeah. But it was such a profound personal experience to me that I was like, okay, I'm not alone in this. I can trust in a higher power and a power greater than myself to restore me to sanity. And I'm not alone. But I was so alone when I was growing up that I felt like I had to do everything by myself. I was like, I default to self-sufficiency, which ends up being like the bane of my existence. I torture myself. You were talking to me about setting personal boundaries. And that is something that not just boundaries with other people, but boundaries with myself, treating myself with kindness, not working myself too hard, doing the self-care, all that stuff is really important.
Ever evolving process. Mm-hmm. I love that you said that undeniable. I just, I don't know why that's like making my brain like spin. Because I think spiritual experiences are so personal. And that's one thing when I get around people who are still so angry with any type of higher anything, spirituality. Yeah, I don't care if you call it source, universe, God, Buddha, whatever you want to call it. Like, to me, when you have something as profound as like that sunrise, and here it was profound enough that a friend of yours printed it on a card and sent it to you. So it was more than just profound to you. Like they saw something, you know, it's an undeniable proof, science, bitch, or whatever, you know, like,
yeah. Breaking Bad reference. I love it.
It's interesting that you have these pivotal moments and they are undeniable, but we do have quick forgetters. So in all the, and I think it gets harder if you're on a constant quest for learning, and I am much the same. Like I'm a Gemini. I like can't figure, I'm a detective. I'm figuring anything out. I'm going to get to the base of the root of what is happening. And I just think when sometimes people like us, we like study ourselves kind of dumb. Like we know all this stuff and can rattle off all these, this information. And it isn't until you have a reminder experience, like, and it's weird because do you see this feather, white feather that came out of nowhere? It's just came out of nowhere.
Wow.
So I take that as a sign that an angel's near, just FYI.
Oh, I love that.
So, I mean, because there's no reason for there to be a white feather anywhere around me at all. Okay. So
is it
anyways,
on your Christmas decorations?
No, because I was just thinking that, but there's not.
That is a trip. God just showed weird. Up.
And it came across the screen and we have a recording of it. undeniable. There's a recording of it.
Yeah.
But I just think that when you have an experience like that and you're able to be like, it moves you to your core. Yeah. It creates this serenity within you. And when I first got sober and I was going through like a total, there's so much chaos. I was so into drama. If I wasn't drinking, I was addicted to drama. Like I was finding the drama. And
it's a distraction from me. Yeah.
Yeah. And my sponsor said, you know, part of getting sober, one of the gifts of getting sober and not just not drinking is that you actually find serenity, and you need to protect that serenity, be in your little bubble and not let things penetrate it. And I think that I fought that for a long time because I was like, well, that's never going to happen. Boundaries. I did, you know, like I said, I wasn't really good at them, when I got sober. So, if you've had all these spiritual experiences, you know, everything about like hypnotherapy and the way that, you know, where our brains are chemically wired, right, to do certain things. And we talked about people pleasing and not wanting to use the X marks the spot word of like alcoholic or like labeling ourselves. But I know that we've talked just that you consider yourself a recovering alcoholic. And I do too. Like I said, I need the reminder because I do have a quick forgetter. And if I were just to say like, oh, I'm, you know, I have just an alcohol use disorder.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I use, it's a disorder. And, you know, to me, there was that just, and maybe for the new people in a younger generation that does help, but I'm like, I need to be reminded that I can go even further down the scale than I went.
Yeah.
And to me, that word, you know, my grandfather died of alcoholism. He died choking on his own vomit by himself, had been banished, you know, from my dad's family. And because my dad's a perfect adult child of an alcoholic, he controls drinking. He is not a big drinker. And he also, my family, my aunts and uncles, none of them really drank very much. And nobody educated us about alcoholism, except for the fact that he died of alcoholism. It wasn't until I got sober that you start hearing these stories of they had to take him in a straitjacket to the hospital to detox. And it's like a full-blown alcoholic, you know, like in my mind. And it's just so interesting how we all don't want to be shamed. And we want, you know, to like not have the stigma or the shame that comes with admitting that you are an addict, alcoholic. I find today, I believed in anonymity pretty hardcore until like I had a real problem with people on social media talking about meetings and the program and their sobriety, mainly because they would go back out. And I'm like, this is not what it's about, like tooting your own horn on social. Sorry if I offend anybody. But I really valued my anonymity at the beginning because honestly, I don't know that I could have done it without feeling like I was safe in a basement of a church without people judging me. And today I'm open about it, obviously. But you have 27 years of sobriety. What do you think, or just to, because I could go on all day with you about a million things. We just did your One Day at a Time podcast show, and now we're doing mine. So what is it you think that that helped you come back home to yourself? Because you had mentioned how your mom said that you came back, you know, when you got sober. But what is it that you think, or what is the memory of being like, oh, I'm me. I feel complete, not the broken, but the completed, healed version.
I mean, when I was drinking and using, I would wake up the next morning and I was like, why am I like this? Like, who is this? I had a sense that I wasn't my true self, but I couldn't not do it, right? And it was my coping skill. I was trying to survive, but my savior was becoming my executioner and I had to stop or I was going to die. I was either going to kill somebody else or myself because I was a frequent drunk driver. And I just hit that bottom and I just knew something had to change. But I did hit the rock bottom. You know, I skipped along the bottom for a little while, for like 2 years, I would say. But I just couldn't do it anymore. I just couldn't do it anymore. And I wanted to be better. And I wanted to be anybody else but me. But as it turned out, when I got sober, I learned who I really was, right? When you scrape away all the crap, you know, then I was just left with who I really was. And it turns out I wasn't a bad person. I was just sick, right? And I just had all these wounds and I needed help. And so that's for me, like where it all began is, they say that you can't hate yourself well. And that's what I had been trying to do. I hated who I was, right? And so I had to, you know, I was so grateful to have that practical, pragmatic process of sorting out, going through the sorting process, like sorting out all my pain, all my resentments, and seeing my patterns of behavior, learning where I could take responsibility and let go of what wasn't mine. And really, and this is why I focus on in my work, I focus on self-esteem, because I firmly believe that we only allow into our lives what we believe we deserve on a subconscious level, right? There are some people who feel so shitty about who they are, they can't receive the solution. And I see people relapse over and over and over again. And then the anonymity of the program and the things that we do about like announcing yourself for the first 30 days, that actually, you know, in some cases can be pro-social shame, but it also can actually be very damaging to have to, you know, I see people, it degrades their self-esteem. And so my work is largely about building self-esteem. You know, I do have a 6-week workshop where we do. So this is what's interesting about the way we think is that everybody already knows what to do. We all know what to do. Like we know if we want to lose weight, we need to diet and eat right. Everybody knows that. Nobody does it. Some people do it.
Well, exactly.
Yeah. But what is holding us back is what we believe we deserve. Also what it's our identity. We have this formed identity that happens by the time you're 6 years old, right? What's crazy is that that's when you develop all your beliefs about the world and yourself, what you're capable of, what you deserve. All that is established by the time, and that is your default mode network, as in neuroscience terms. And then we spend the rest of our lives but we're making decisions about ourselves as children without context, right? So you're a little kid, you run a mom and you're demanding or whatever, and she's had the worst day of her life and she's like, just shut up or whatever she says, right? And we walk away thinking that we're not worthy, we're alone in this, that, you know, we're not good enough or whatever, that I'm too much or not enough or whatever. We develop these beliefs about ourselves and then we develop these coping skills to overcome. Right. So like for me, it was all about achievement and workaholism and people pleasing just so that I could feel okay. And so the work that I do is about deconstructing the unworthiness. Like it's about the recovery process, about undoing unworthiness, which is about, it's really about going inside out, getting to the subconscious belief system through things like hypnosis to uncover the negative belief system and reframe those ideas, give that inner child context and perspective. It's like, no, you weren't a bad person. Mom was tired. She was middle-aged. She was afraid. She was tired. I mean, you know, she was just had a bad day. It wasn't you personally. She did the best she could, you know, and it wasn't good enough. You know, she's human. Like nobody escapes childhood without some issues. That's life.
Right.
Yeah. So the work that I do to help women heal is, and I do it in a workshop, because women will show up for each other in a way that we won't show up for ourselves individually, right?
100%.
So the workshop is live. We do the exercises in class together. You and I share a love for the Joe Dispenza's work, right? So this is about laws of attraction, science, cause and effect. And I do have a spiritual practice. So bringing in, you know, a spiritual component, I think, is important. And really, you know, a self-care practice, it's a built-in self-esteem. That's the whole point of a class, but a support system. We do things like willingness calls. The girls have to call each other. I only do it for women. And at the moment, and I make them do willingness calls, which is you have to call somebody. You have to be willing to call somebody and say, hey, I'm just checking in. Because the number one thing I hear when people are early in recovery is I don't want to call and bother anybody. Right. But what they don't realize is that when, like, I love getting phone calls. Oh, somebody thought to call me. Like, oh, I love getting phone calls. Somebody wants my advice. Are you kidding me? Sign me up. But I make them do willingness calls. And what that does is that they get in the habit of being current with several people. That way, if the shit hits the fan, as life does, that if the first person you call isn't available, you have a few other people you can call and you're current with everybody so that you don't have to spend a lot of time on the backstory. You can get right into solution. And solution, by the way, is validation and acknowledgement of the pain first. And then solution. The whole spiritual bypassing thing, you know, that's a spiritual bypassing is skipping over the process of metabolizing pain and going straight for a solution, which is completely and literally invalidating the pain. But that's our natural instinct as people in recovery, is that we don't want to feel any pain, right? But pain shared is lessened. Right. And so we share our pain, we get honest, we share the pain, it diffuses it, right? We're diffusing anger, we're diffusing pain. Anger, by the way, is a secondary emotion. It's rooted in, you know, Tara Brach is an amazing person who wrote a book called Radical Acceptance. And she talks about anger being a sign of an unmet need, not a want, a need, right? And so when we don't get our needs met, we get angry, you know, it's a coping skill. And that's actually, anger is my go-to thing. I wasn't allowed to feel sad when I was growing up. It was anger. And so when I get angry, I know now that, oh, that's a red flag for me. I'm actually sad about something. So anyway, so the whole idea of the class is that we get to reinvent. The class is actually called Reinvent. We're reinventing our identity. We're reinventing what we believe we deserve. We're building our self-esteem, because the whole premise of the class is we only allow into our lives what we believe we deserve on a subconscious level. Because whether people want to admit it or not, we make decisions emotionally and justify logically. I learned that from 10 years of sales, tech sales, is that people really, they buy emotionally and justify logically. And so that's how all our decisions are made. So if you have a presupposition that you don't deserve to be happy, or that you have to struggle to get anything good, that was my subconscious belief, then that's very problematic, you know, as you move through life.
Yeah, that's incredible. And it's a workshop. They can sign up, so people can find you if they're looking for you and reinvent themselves, or just learn more about you on Instagram, right?
Yeah, they can go to at ODAT podcast, and ODAT is spelled ODAAT. I did not think it through when I named my podcast.
Well, it's initially. One day at a time. So yeah, that's the acronym, you know?
Yeah, one day at a time. Yeah, it's a one day at a time podcast. Anyway, I put everything on Sober Life School, because that's sort of like the hub. That's where you can get to the self-esteem class. That's where you can get to the podcast, or that's where you can get to me if you want to book time with me to do some. I offer a free strategy call. It's like, I've been sober a long time. I have a good sense of being able to evaluate where someone is at and present solutions, whether they're with me or not. I don't even really care, to be perfectly honest. It's like, if I can help you, great. If not, I have all kinds of people that can help you. I'm connected. That's my get down. I'm connected to the sobriety community, and I know a ton of coaches.
That's the power of community and having people and that do the same kind of work that your friends, you know, that you're plugged in with.
And I don't believe in scarcity. Like, if you don't want to work with me, that's cool, because there are tons of people who are willing to work. Like, all my needs are met. I don't, you know what I mean? But I do want to share. Yeah, I am driven to share the things that I have learned to help end suffering for others. So if it's not me, if I can direct you to somebody else, I mean, listen, truth be told, there's enough crazy to go around, right?
Yeah.
I don't need to help everybody.
There is.
But if, if I can't help you, I know somebody who can. That's the thing. So call, you know, I'm a real person. Call me, set up some time. We can talk. You can DM me. And if you just need a pointer in the right direction, I'm your girl. I'm here to help. That's my mission in life now.
Love that. So I will definitely call you and reach out. And
please,
everyone
do.
Listening today, head over to Instagram and reach out if you're looking for some guidance or want to just soak up some of her awesomeness. You can do that over there. So thanks so much for coming on the show today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I adore you. You're doing amazing work. Thanks so much.
Looking forward to our Dispenza retreat.
Me too.
Loved this episode of the Desperately Seeking Self podcast? Head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. I really appreciate it. And thanks for listening. For free resources and materials, head over to my website at innovativecoachbrooke.com. Thanks so much. Have a good week.